Hello, Tom. I'd like you to define the word irony.
Sort of like iron. I asked Terry Pratchett that once, and he said that, and I was like, I deserve
very good.
That.
Yeah, no, you can't deny that. No, yeah. Tom, I'm going to give you the definition of irony, the real definition of irony right now, which is there's a bunch of researchers out there who claim to study the topic of misinformation, but the irony is that, in fact, they are spreading loads of misinformation and doing bullshit science. And in fact, the whole topic of misinformation, in many ways, is bullshit.
Okay, that is indeed ironic. But I will say that's actually an example of irony, not a definition of irony. So I've really, okay. But that's not the important thing.
Next to irony in the dictionary, you could have misinformation studies. I think, it gives me no pleasure to say that, because I consider myself and you as well, Tom. Yeah. Like a misinformation debunker kind of person.
Yeah, I mean, of course, that's what we try and do here. To some extent, I don't know. We'll see where we go with all this, but yes. To some extent, I find the entire concept of like misinformation studies as a separate thing baffling. Because aren't we all trying to work out things that are true and not believe things that aren't true? You know, that isn't that just like the whole idea of sifting through the complex reality?
That may indeed come back up again. Like how we define any of this stuff. There's a whole scientific field here which has become very prominent in the last few years, particularly, I think you can, obviously the pandemic is a big part of it, but the before that, the 2016 election, I think, was a big kind of driver of this idea that there's loads of misinformation around.
Fueled by the Russians in that case.
Yeah, the Russian thing in that particular case, yeah. I'm going to argue in this episode that the societal discussion of misinformation has gone completely off the rails. Mm-hmm. Very prominent figures in the field of misinformation research have revealed themselves to be incredibly naive, very poor scientists, and maybe even potentially quite dangerous. Mm-hmm. That might seem concerning. But that's what we're gonna do in this episode of the Study Show, to which you're very welcome. If you want to hear the whole thing, as you'll have heard, please become a paid subscriber. If you are a paid subscriber, then thank you very much.
Yes, we love you and we want to cherish you.
Yeah. And a little thing before we start is, yes, we've said that misinformation studies is bullshit and so on, but actually, we're going to rely on a lot of work done by scholars who are interested in misinformation here. There are lots of sensible people who work on this topic. Mm. So we're not saying that everything in this entire field is a load of nonsense. It's not homeopathy or something like that. But we're saying that there's a very prominent strain of this type of research which has gone very wrong.
Yeah, there is obviously information which is not true, which does exist. We do not deny that some information is not connected to reality. Yeah.
As you say, that's what we try and do in this podcast. We dig into the evidence, work out, you know, if there's misconceptions about a particular area and see if they fit with the evidence. And we often find that the evidence does not back up what people believe. But something a bit strange has happened in these recent years since misinformation has become such a big topic. And now every time anyone mentions misinformation or disinformation.
Yes, and there is a distinction, isn't there? Is it misinformation is accidental and disinformation is deliberate? Or is there
disinformation is something which you see a lot of. If you read history books, you read like, you know, the Nazis were trying to spread disinformation to about troop movements and where invasions were happening and stuff in order to confuse the Allies during the Second World War. Like this is and obviously right the way through the Cold War, there's all sorts of disinformation going around.
Yeah, Operation Paperclip and all that sort of stuff.
Super common term. But now you hear them mentioned together, misinformation and disinformation.
Yeah.
And when I see people talk about it, my eye does a little twitch and I just feel like someone's about to say something very naive or embarrassing or wrong whenever anyone mentions it. And it shouldn't be this way, Tom.
No, it shouldn't.
The people who care about what's true, that should be a great thing.
Mm. The trouble is that people care about what's true, but they sort of, when they don't like things that aren't true, but they would like to be true. You know, in that's yes. the when it's sort of, oh, it's politically inconvenient that this is true or yes. not true or something like that.
Yeah. We're all human and we are subject to human biases in various ways, as we will discuss. So let's get into it.
Yes.
Now, there's some overlap between this debate and the one that we did a few months back on social media, because, of course, a major vector of social media now, and the reason that it's become such a big topic is because everyone's on social media. Everyone is seeing, apparently, lots and lots of misinformation on there.
Yep.
We talked about mental health in our previous episode, like mental health effects of social media. But, of course, a lot of people worry that social media is, you know, showing people misinformation, making them behave differently, making them vote differently, making them more polarized politically, taking like health risks and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the argument is that we're just swimming in a sea of misinformation these days, and we're in a post-truth society, and you know, you hear all these kind of things that have now become cliches, and something needs to be done about this. And in fact, it can be done, and we'll talk about what can be done later on.
You say it can, in fact, be done, but the claim is that it can be done.
That's the claim. We're swimming in a sea of misinformation, and something can be done about it. That's very much the claim made by some academics who have made this their career. Made this a career. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So people talk about misinformation this sort of variety of ways. I've heard it described as sort of a disease and a virus. There's something that's spread. I suppose like the virus analogy is, you know, it sort of spreads around. There's got an R number that what spreads from one person to the next, and it's contagious.
Yeah, it's like a social virus that goes from person to person. Yeah.
And then you catch it and you have the disease. And I've seen some people, you know, saying it can even kill you. So I suppose it, you know, has a fatality rate or whatever as well.
Yeah, if you believe something really bad, I guess, like
vaccines.
if you're an anti-vaxxer,
Yeah. Well, that's not completely implausible. I mean, like, it's going through a few layers there, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
But it's not mad.
The thing is, I don't think any of these views are kind of like completely insane to believe. It's just they come along with lots of other things, which we'll get into.
Yeah.
We mentioned an article a few episodes ago about a quarter of people in the UK believe COVID was a hoax. And that was written by Mariana Spring, who is the BBC's quote. I think the quote usually is the first disinformation and social media correspondent of the BBC, and you'll have seen her. I mean, if you pay
how
any
many
attention
do they intend to have? Like, sorry, the first, but the
that's
first
true. Yeah. It's an interesting question. You'll have seen Mariana Spring if you've paid any attention to the BBC, because she's everywhere. She does podcasts and articles, and is on the telly and is everywhere, talking about misinformation, disinformation, how the effects spill offline from online, so people start to commit acts in real life, you know, after being exposed to misinformation, and
which must be true sometimes, right?
Totally.
I mean, do you remember the guy who turned up at the Pizzagate pizza parlor with a gun? It's like, where's Bill Clinton, and where's he hiding all the children, whatever it was, you know?
I made my friend, when I was in Washington DC last time, made my friend take me to Comet Ping Pong, which is the pizza restaurant in question, just to see, to be there at the heart
of
that
heart
particular
conspiracy. Yeah.
There's no basement there. I had a look around. There's no basement in the building.
That's what they want you to believe, well, Stuart.
yeah, it's true. There could be behind any of those doors. There could be anything, I suppose. Again, it's not mad to believe that, but the fundamental point that we're going to make in a lot of this episode, spoiler alert, is that it's drastically exaggerated how bad this stuff is. Like the article that said a quarter of people in the UK believe that COVID was a hoax, it can't possibly be true.
Of course it can't. They all saw it happen.
It's silly nonsense. It's not true. And it's ironic that people who are misinformation and disinformation people are spreading this kind of thing. You also hear it in the context of hate crimes,
misinformation about I don't know, racial minorities. I think minorities inspire greater attacks on them. There was a lot of that. Do you remember when Boris Johnson wrote that piece for the Telegraph, which actually was a bit grim. It wasn't a particularly nice thing to read, but like another weird irony that he was writing a thing about we shouldn't be like the French and ban burqas and so on. We should, you know, we are British and we should be liberal and people should be able to wear what they like.
Yes.
But it wasn't very nice.
But he described as Muslim women who wear niqab.
Yes.
With, you know, the sort of just slit where you can see
their eyes
through. as letterboxes, which
it's unpleasant
and, you know, a bit racist, I guess. So I'm happy to call that, you know, that bad. But yes, there was a whole thing about that called then spilling out into anti-Islamic hate crimes and so on.
Yeah, there was a claim that it led to a 300 or something. I wrote a piece about it at the time, the claim that it led to a 300% spike in anti-Muslim hate crimes or attacks and so on. And as this is obviously like a paywalled piece in the Telegraph, maybe 20,000, you know, maybe 50,000 people read it, you know, like the idea that this has caused a nationwide spike is just completely mad.
I think another fundamental theme of this episode is that people believe that other people are a lot more gullible and influenced by, you know, messages that they've seen online.
Yeah,
than they really are, and that's, we've talked about that in the context of social psychology before.
Yes, priming
as well. That social psychologists believe everyone's just being blown around like a leaf in the wind.
Yeah.
You know, buffeted by every single bit of, you know, every single little word or phrase they see.
Yeah, no one has a stable personality. They're just like, oh, yeah. I recently saw a thing that's implied oldness, so I'll walk really slowly now.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about it for a second, it's really daft. Yeah. And we mentioned before the final example that we can just to give a flavor of how people talk about this is obviously during COVID. Hmm. The World Health Organization, having declared the pandemic, also declared an infodemic.
Oh, that sounds bad.
Which, is like. Hmm. All the false claims that came around COVID, and there were. And in fact, full disclosure, I, with some friends, created a website to debunk some of the common COVID claims. So again, I consider myself like a misinformation debunker kind of person, like a skeptic-y type person.
Well, again,
like this.
For the third time, that's what we try and do here. Like,
it's,
you know,
it's a good thing to do. It's a good thing to do, exactly. Yeah. So, again, spoiler alert, despite all the claims you see about all of these, you know, the world is awash with misinformation and social media is this major vector and it's a disease, blah, blah, blah. Mm. The evidence isn't actually particularly good for what would be considered three of the main tenets of the kind of misinformation studies view. And that was shown really clearly in this Nature paper that came out just a couple of months ago.
Oh, yeah.
It's called Misunderstanding the Harms of Online Misinformation. And it's a really comprehensive review of all the research on this, effectively, all the relevant research on this topic. Mm. And a really useful kind of zooming out of what does the evidence actually say? Like, we can pick up on individual studies, but what does the evidence actually say on these three questions? And the three questions are, does the average person get exposed to a lot of misinformation on social media? Like, if you look at the discourse, you'd think there was an enormous amount of misinformation all the time. People are getting exposed to this, right? That's generally the impression you get.
Yeah, Twitter or X, whatever it's called nowadays, or Facebook is just this sort of fire hose of fake stuff.
Yes,
pouring out. Yeah. I mean, and I'm sure there is lots of fake stuff on there. To be clear, a lot of AI generated stupid things or whatever. But yeah,
and that is probably getting worse as AI gets better. You know. Mm. And then the second claim is algorithms are really responsible for pushing people into more and more extreme views. So you know, how bad are algorithms is the second question they look at.
Ooh, algorithms.
Exactly. And then the third one is, to what extent does this misinformation cause people's behavior to change? That's just being exposed to misinformation is one thing, but then the question is, what effect does that have on you? And as we know from endless episodes of this podcast, it's really... really difficult to investigate what causes behavioral changes.
Yes.
So we'll get into that. Let's go through them in turn.
Let's go and have a look. All right. So the first one, remind me, that was the average how much misinformation the average person gets exposed to. So tell me what we know about that.
Well, what we know about that is that if you ask people how much misinformation they think they see on social media, or they think the average person sees in social media, in a 2018 poll, Americans said that 65% of what the average person sees on social media is misinformation, and only 39% in traditional media.
Oh, I'm already just seeing all sorts of definitional problems looming on the horizon.
Yeah, totally. 65% is the campaign to get people to believe that misinformation is a major problem has been a huge success.
Yes.
Regardless of whether it is a major problem or not, it's been massively successful. If people think that 65% of what they see on social media is misinformation, then that is an incredible coup for those who want you to believe that misinformation is like this huge, terrible crisis.
Yeah, especially since like 65% of it is like jokes and videos of people doing TikTok challenges, you know? Like
well, exactly. And we'll come to the numbers. First of all, though, as you say, definitional problems abound here. It's very difficult to measure not only misinformation, like how do you label misinformation? And there are various ways that people have tried, and we'll encounter this a few times exactly. Like, what do you say is misinformation compared to what do you say is reliable? But also, it's difficult to gather information on people's interactions on social media, like how much they see and compared to how much they interact with and so on. Like, you know how Twitter, since Elon Musk took over, now has a little counter for tweets that shows you how many times people saw that tweet?
Yeah.
And that's the number on that is always drastically higher than the number of people who have clicked like on it.
Thousands of times higher. Sometimes you see tweets that have got a million views and like 100 people have actually clicked on it.
Yeah, exactly. So it depends on, you know, who has, you know, shared that information in their feed and so on. And it turns out that a lot of the research is done on, you know, it's done on data sets that are given by organizations like Facebook and so on. And it turns out that a lot of the information is based on interactions rather than impressions or views.
Yeah.
Whether someone's sharing something or liking something on Facebook or retweeting it on Twitter and so on for other social media networks.
Okay, so you've already got a bit of a bias because the stuff people click on, the stuff people engage with is the stuff that they maybe not always like, but the stuff that sparks their interest in some way. So
exactly. You've
already, yeah, okay.
It sparks their interest and, you know, there's also other like complex motivations going on there. Like when you click like on something, you know that will then increase the numbers that are under that tweet. Maybe if you're sophisticated, you know that if you like something, then that'll improve its
boost
position
its
in the algorithm, which will then make it spread further. You want it to go a bit further and so on. So it's not the same as just stuff that you see. You interact with stuff that you already like in a lot of cases. You share stuff that you want to show to your friends because you think it's important or interesting or funny or whatever it is, or otherwise, you know, you want to have some kind of closer engagement with it in some sense.
So there could be, for to sort of make the point in a concrete way as possible, someone could be sitting there and 99 things come past saying vaccines seem broadly safe and effective, and apart from the occasional problem they have, that they're generally been good for humanity, and you sort of scroll past and ignore them, and then one comes up saying vaccine caused my child's autism. You click on that because you bang 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 love that, and that's that, then that's what these studies would show is your media diet sort of thing. So this guy just saw one tweet, 100% of his social media engagement was this one, you know, whatever it was.
So this is an example that they give in the paper that, you know, just to show how difficult it is to actually collect data on what people have seen rather than what they've engaged with. Now, that leads on to the next point, which is a lot of the numbers don't use the right denominator. So here's a quote from the paper. Facebook reported that content made by Russian trolls from the Internet Research Agency, so that's some troll farm where they make content and try and spread it through the Western internet, reached as many as 126 million US citizens on Facebook before the 2016 US presidential election, a statistic that was widely cited in the press and in studies on Internet Research Agency operations. So that sounds a lot. Like, there's only 330 million people in the US. 126 million have seen content made by Russian trolls.
That sounds impressive, but...
But they go on to say, quote again, far less attention was paid to the estimate that such content represented 0.004% of the content that US citizens saw in Facebook newsfeed.
Okay, so that's 0.004%. So 4 in 100,000 items would be misinformation.
Created by this particular Russian troll. I mean the whole total misinformation number might be higher than that, but
I'm sure it would be much higher, of course. Yes, but it was this specific lot of people. So you're right. So they're neglecting the they're neglecting the denominator there, which is this great irony for me, because so many of the pieces I've written saying, well, maybe this is the reason this might not be really a useful way of looking at this story or whatever, is so often it's denominator neglect. You know, right. some story saying, oh, you know, one person dies of marshmallow overdose every 2 weeks or something. So, okay, but how many people were exposed to marshmallows in that time? What's the absolute risk for it? And if you don't give the denominator,
maybe it's basically everyone in the country.
Yeah, exactly. And you don't know. I don't know why I said marshmallows, but you know,
Something everyone likes.
Exactly.
And coffee, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Coffee would be a brilliant example. Or vaping, you know?
Like, yes.
You see, 6 people died from those, whatever it was, those poison vapes a few years ago. And there were tens of millions of people using them. Like, it's misinformation.
It's own kind of misinformation to do that. Mm. So there's lots of other examples in the paper. It's basically anyone who's interested in this should read this paper. It's really a really nice review. Mm. Not only that, but if you take the average amount of misinformation that somebody's exposed to online, that is, you just take the average, then you're allowing the extreme users or extreme consumers of misinformation to skew the numbers. And we'll talk about the kind of extreme users again as we go through. But to take just one example, according to one study they cite in the review, 1% of YouTube viewers watched 85% of all the vaccine skeptical content on the website. So like, it's concentrated a lot in a very small set of people. That's not even the Pareto principle, where 20% of people do 80% of, you know, whatever it is. 1% of people are doing 85% of vaccine skeptic stuff. People get obsessed with these, you know, these things. And then if you just look at the average amount, then your hypothetical mythical average person is going to seem like they see a hell of a lot more misinformation than they
do. This is the old, if Bill Gates walks into any room, everyone in that, the average person becomes a millionaire,
right? You know? Right, exactly, because he's just so rich. So the quote there, I've been talking a lot, Tom, you can read this one.
All right. We believe that the conclusions of the academic research are clear. Exposure to misinformation is low as a percentage of people's information diets and concentrated among a small minority. However, this reality is not reflected in public discourse about social media.
Well, exactly. And just to emphasize, like we said at the start, this is all stuff that's from the academic literature. We're not saying that, like, all the literature on this is a load of nonsense, because, of course, we're actually relying on academic studies.
Yeah.
It's just that when you zoom out and look at them as a whole and really give a sober analysis of them, it's really very far from the public discussion on this stuff, which, again, does seem quite ironic.
Yes, it does. It does seem unfortunate, doesn't it?
Given the topic at hand.
It's like if cancer research accidentally giving people cancer.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Which, by putting people
probably
off
does
fakes,
happen
in a sense.
Yeah.
Second point, algorithms. People like Marianne Spring and people like that, when they talk about algorithms, they don't even give any additional context. They just say algorithms. Ooh. And it's a kind of a boo word. Yeah. You know, this is this terrifying, you know, thing, algorithms. Mm. But of course, everything's based on algorithms. Like, algorithms is a neutral term, which can refer to lots of different things. But the story is, and you'll have heard this a million times, you've seen examples of this on, you know, in the news, on TV, everywhere. Mm. You've got a nice, moderate person, and they go on YouTube and they start watching political content. And then they see something that's a little bit more extreme and a little bit more extreme than that. And then they get sucked in. The algorithm gives them the next thing. Here, watch this next, watch this next. And it's more extreme, it's more extreme. And before you know it, they're a skinhead neo-Nazi goose stepping down the street and saying Heil Hitler.
Yeah, many, many such cases.
That's a slightly exaggerated version, but that's basically what you hear a lot.
It is, yeah.
I know you don't watch many videos on YouTube, Tom.
No, I don't, because it sucks. And I want these. Why can't these lazy bastards just write down how to fix a washing machine so I don't have to watch a 40-minute video? It would make my life a lot easier.
I think that you might be looking a gift horse in the mouth, Tom, given that there's lots of free content about
how to fix a washing machine,
on YouTube, and how to fix all sorts of things, your toilet. All sorts of stuff. I've fixed my toilet using a YouTube video relatively recently.
I'm very pleased to hear it. I'll use a plunger myself.
Yeah. So you don't have much experience of YouTube, but No. I watch YouTube stuff. Yeah, I'll watch all sorts of stuff, music videos, political stuff. I'll watch all sorts of stuff on YouTube.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's really not been my impression at all that I'm being fed more extreme stuff at all. I get more of the same sort of stuff that I've watched before. And often to the point that I'm desperate to see something a bit different, and I'm sick when I look at the YouTube feed. I think, oh, I'm sick of all this stuff.
For God's sake, show me the Nuremberg rallies.
Show me something. Show me something more extreme, you know. But I never get that stuff. And maybe that's, you know, it's possible that algorithms have changed now than they were a few years ago.
Maybe.
Now that people are more aware of this issue.
Or maybe you're just not representative. Maybe you're a very, very boring person. And
obviously,
the algorithms
this is,
that's
certainly true. Yeah. Certainly true.
And it just says, oh, this guy needs more and more mediocre stuff every time. What he's desperate for.
This is, you know, it's obviously just my anecdotal experience. What does the evidence actually show? Well, in the paper, they say the results suggest, and they describe lots of different studies, that algorithms typically show people from content from accounts they chose to follow or content in which they indicated interest. As a result, exposure levels may reflect people's preferences more than they shape them.
Wait. So social media and video sites want to give you things that you like so that you stay on the site. This is shocking.
An amazing revelation, Tom.
Yeah. Sorry.
But that is indeed what seems to be the case. The causality may well be in the opposite direction. People choose to look at this stuff rather than it shaping them. Again, it's not like people are just big lumps of clay and they get manipulated by all the stuff on YouTube. So here's some evidence that they mentioned in the study. In fact, you can take this one if you want, Tom.
Yeah,
again.
Sure. Although, you know, you keep saying this, but here you are sitting on the, I can see you with your little toothbrush moustache on the video and your SS uniform. Like, I don't watch anything
extreme.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, people who consume videos from extremist channels on YouTube in the USA are more likely to have previously expressed high levels of hostile sexism and racial resentment.
So these are links to specific studies that have shown these.
Yeah. Many actively seek out extremist content by following links from alternative and fringe social media sites such as 4chan and or subscribing to the channel in question. Similarly, 41% of views of videos classified in previous research as far right on YouTube took place after people followed a link from an external URL, and 36% were directly preceded by another video on the site. By contrast, only 0.4% of algorithmic recommendations directed users to extremist channel videos on YouTube.
So again, this whole panic about algorithms leading you down the rabbit hole into conspiracy stuff, I'm sure that does happen for some people. You know, they see something that they wouldn't otherwise have seen. But it seems like in, you know, some huge proportion of cases, this just isn't happening. People are seeking this stuff out.
Yeah, they're choosing it. They're choosing, like, this, or they're like, I am, you know, I'm a horrible racist and sexist, so I click on things that are horribly racist and sexist. I'm speaking in character here. I'm not actually.
Clip that.
Yeah,
exactly. So it looks like there's a big effect of people choosing to watch certain stuff and choosing to be in a bubble, you know, this whole idea of the filter bubble and so on, and not seeing stuff that they, you know, that goes outside of their ideological sphere, yeah. Rather than the algorithms being to blame. And yeah, there are some cases where people are shown bad stuff by algorithms, but any discussion of that needs to take into account the reverse causation, you know, explanation as well.
The fact that people make choices and click on things they like.
Exactly. Yeah. And this fits with, you know, we previously mentioned this, but also a point made by the philosopher Dan Williams, who has been a major critic of this whole misinformation studies thing. He's got some great articles. We'll link to several of them in the show notes. If anything, he points out, and by the way, this is something which, again, if you step back, you should be aware of this. If anything, people are too stubborn when they see new stuff. People want to just see stuff that they like already.
Yeah.
They go to great lengths to avoid changing their mind, and they're really biased against changing their mind and being influenced by new stuff. Think about confirmation bias and, you know.
Yeah, which everyone shouts at each other on the internet. Oh, he's just confirmation, he just wants to believe the things he already believes. He looks out. We all it's just people, we get this, people say, people get cross at you for not changing your mind. They get cross at you for changing your mind. It's just people get cross when you don't believe the same things they believe.
Yes. But, yes, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
I'm being grumpy there.
Yeah. But I was thinking, like, there's whole movements of people who are trying to make changing your mind a virtue, like the whole, you know, the rationalist thing.
I know them because my first book was entirely about them. And if you want to go, The Rationalist Guide to the Galaxy. By me, go and buy it.
By Tom Chivers. It's available on all good book websites and in all good bookshops. Yeah.
They're very weird people.
As you describe in the book, they're very weird.
They're very, very weird
people. It's very strange when someone changes their mind in a substantial way. And we make a big deal of it, you know, when they do, because it's a highly unusual thing.
Like that Dawkins anecdote.
The Dawkins anecdote about the guy who used to believe that there was a certain part of the cell, the Golgi apparatus, that doesn't exist. And then he was shown incontrovertible evidence that it did exist. And he went up and said, you've convinced me, I've been wrong all these years. And everyone's clapping their hands.
Thank you very much. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
Dawkins says it gives him a tear in his eye every time he remembers it. You know, it shouldn't be that unusual, but it is, because we're all human and we don't like to change our mind.
Yeah.
All of it just to say, our prior, in this case, to use Bayesian,
which is very appropriate here because it's about updating our minds, changing our minds.
Our prior here should be that it should be really hard to change people's minds. This is like meta-Bayesianism here.
Hmm.
That people choose to look at things they already agree with, and that the small amount of misinformation that they see online, which we've all already established that as a part of your entire information diet, misinformation for most people, for the average person, is a very, very small amount.
Yeah.
It seems that that's unlikely to really, you know, change your mind substantially. And again, this misinformation view is that people are just blown around by everything they see and just influenced by every single message. And almost like people are quite stupid and that they're influenced by everything that they see.
Yeah, like growth mindset and things like that. Just this tiny little, or social priming is the classic, you know, just a tiny little intervention that you don't even notice. And look, oh, you've suddenly gone off to work really hard and become an A grade student or whatever.
Which you wouldn't have done otherwise.
Yeah, exactly. And which just doesn't work. Doesn't stand up when you look at the details.
Exactly. Of course, like, you do have to ask how people who do, you know, anti-vaxxers and so on, how they got those beliefs in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And there's kind of a chicken and egg or infinite regress or something issue here, where like somebody at some point has to have been influenced by some of these views in order to hold them. And there were a lot of people during the COVID pandemic who held anti-vaccine views and so on. But of course, like the question is, you know, whether the social media and algorithms are causing these, and people had mad beliefs about stuff long before social media and long before the internet. So,
well. The Wakefield stuff, I mean, I'm sure we'll come back to it, but, you know, like people went crazy for anti-vax stuff in the late 90s, early 2000s, long before anyone knew what Twitter was.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, you know, the question about whether it's social media that's doing this does seem to be...
An open question,
exactly, exactly. Yeah. Final point here is causality.
Yeah.
And we've talked an awful lot in the, I believe now, year...
Yeah, a year. The producer messages to say happy first birthday to the study show. I think it has it about now. A
My
year.
God, yeah, yeah. July rings a bell for when we started. Yeah, yeah. 2023. Yeah, we've talked about causality. What causes what? And it turns out that it's really difficult to study causality. It's very easy to do a correlational study. Well, relatively easy to do a correlational study, whereas it's very difficult to do
to determine causal effect. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
What actually causes what? And basically the argument in this Nature paper about the misinformation study stuff is that there's only very sparse, and they argue inadequate, scientific evidence of a causal effect of misinformation on people's behaviors and beliefs and so on. So it could easily be, after all, that things like polarization and believing incorrect facts cause you to go and use social media more. So you get your angry at the other side, or you get some sort of belief about vaccines or whatever it is in your head, and then you go and use social media more, and that causes you, it sort of animates you to go and do stuff, rather than the other way around.
Yeah, which could of course end up being a double causality thing.
Yeah, like a reciprocal causality.
Yeah, you go and do that. You find, there's that classic. The green text meme of recent, like, you know, in, was it year. year 1990, so someone decides they want to have sex with a toaster, everyone says, don't do that, go stop. And then year 2020, someone decides they want to go and have sex with a toaster, it says they go online, find toasterlovers.com, yep. and ruin their life.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, exactly.
So there could be, you know, it could be that causality is complex, it's just you need to prove this stuff or show it.
Exactly. Yeah. But there aren't many experiments. There's some like natural experiments and so on. But in general, the review says the evidence is mixed and unconvincing, as you'd expect for something like this. So they say...
Do you want me to get the quote?
So please.
Really, yep. Okay. Experiments varying individual features of the platform have also yielded mixed results. Although increasing exposure to cross-cutting news decreased effective polarization, decreasing exposure to content from like-minded sources had no effect. Stuart, do you want to explain to us what that means?
They've tried to manipulate Facebook, for instance, and show people more stuff that they wouldn't ordinarily see that would go against their that would go against their political views. And it seems that there's at least one study that shows that that makes people less polarized. Okay. But then if you decrease the amount of exposure to stuff that you would ordinarily see, that has no effect, according to yet another study.
Okay.
So again, it's like we don't have strong evidence on this from experimental studies.
Yeah. Just things pointing in different directions, not really making sense. Yeah. Panel data similarly suggests that the causality goes in the opposite direction. Effective polarization predicts media use, not the other way around. So that's saying what you're saying.
That was the thing about you get really riled up about something and you go and, you know, hammer out a message on Facebook or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Rather than Facebook causing you to be really, really angry about something.
Yeah.
Although again, I'm sure it can go both ways. It's not that these things are impossible.
No, it's just that it hasn't been, I mean, it's the same, but I suppose this is the great irony of all this, right? We're not saying the stuff isn't true, but like we say, for everything else, it's very hard to show and the evidence is bad, and going in this field of all fields,
yes,
coming in really confidently saying this thing is definitely true when you haven't got the evidence to back it up is really bad.
Yes. And again, ironic.
Yeah, exactly.
Another thing I'd add is, and this came up a lot during COVID, is that a lot of cases where the effects of misinformation are measured, it's on people's intentions. Mm-hmm. So it's not actually on their behaviors. It's on what they report in a questionnaire that they will do. So most classically, the intention to vaccinate or, you know, get your kids vaccinated, get vaccinated yourself. That doesn't translate perfectly to reality. People say things in questionnaires, which they don't necessarily do. And sure, of course, it'll be linked to it. But when you get, when you find some effect of misinformation on people's intentions, you then have to multiply that by the link between their intention
and actions,
how likely they are to actually do it. And that multiplication is going to be by a fraction and it's going to make the effect smaller.
Yeah.
So if there is a causal effect of misinformation on stuff like vaccination intentions or on vaccination behaviors, it's probably smaller than we think because we've been only looking at intentions. In a lot of the studies,
but and to be clear, once again, we're not saying there is no causal effect. The Wakefield thing we already discussed, but that was obviously misinformation that was spread and did affect actual real. Well,
yeah.
At least I should be virtuous and say that in the years afterwards, vaccination rates dropped in the UK, and it seems very plausible that there was a causal link there.
Yeah, yeah. You know? I believe that there was a causal link, although I think it's smaller than you would think. Mm-hmm. It doesn't jump out dramatically from if you look at the graphs of vaccination rates and so on. And of course, there was an interesting dynamic there. I mean, this study was published in The Lancet, for heaven's sake. Yeah. It was then amplified by the traditional press. As you said earlier, we didn't have social media back then. Certain people then sort of self-sorted themselves into anti-vaccine groups where they started seeking out even more stuff of that nature,
which would have often been in like Usenet groups or equivalent. That was like not the 90s early internet, but you know, but yeah,
90s and early 2000s version of social media. And so it's really hard to know what the effect of the misinformation per se is. And what misinformation are you talking about? Are you talking about misinformation in the paper, in the Lancet paper? Are you talking about it in the Daily Mail, who wrote about it? Or, it's very hard to study that causal question.
And also, if the source of your misinformation is one of the most widely respected medical journals in the world, then I don't know if you can that becomes very complicated in this sort of saying, well, it's social, you know, that it's coming from a medical journal, for God's sake.
Come back to this.
Yes. Yeah.
I do believe that many of these things have a causal effect. I believe that Wakefield has a causal effect. And you know, if I could go back in time and stop that study from being published in The Lancet, I would do my best. Hmm. And of course, in situations like a pandemic where there's loads of stuff flying around, nobody really knows, it's very, very difficult to know what's happening. Everything's moving very fast. That can potentially be even worse. And that's why I made that, you know, COVID claims debunking website. But it does seem like the pandemic and maybe the 2016 election and other stuff like that has kind of given people license to make pretty outrageous claims about the effects of misinformation more generally.
Yeah. I don't know if this is the time to bring this up, but something that keeps bubbling. You know, we talked about definitional problems, but it's just fascinating to me that people are happy to talk about misinformation in this, like it's a stable and well-defined category in its own right. You know, we can obviously all agree there are some things that, like, I don't know, like Russian propaganda calling, you know, saying the Ukrainian regime is fascist and all this sort of stuff. I don't know. We can agree that's probably disinformation.
I think that would be described as a, like, that's the sort of thing I mentioned, like the World War II stuff, like disinformation or Cold War stuff as well.
Yeah.
That's when one country wants to spread, you know,
propaganda.
About another country.
But like, the thing that interests me is like lab leak theories, right? That was a lot of people said it was misinformation and, you know, sort of racist misinformation. I think it's probably not true, but there were a lot of people who, didn't seem an unreasonable thing to be sort of saying, or to be concerned about, but people were labeling that as misinformation. Is it just things some people think are wrong? I don't know. I read this book a few years ago for a review for Unheard, which was arguing there was this clear line between conspiracy theories and conspiracies, and the difference was like the latter there's evidence for, and the former there's no evidence for, and that's for this. But like, there often is truth in them. Like,
he's gone mad, everyone.
Yeah, well, the chemicals in the water are turning the freaking frogs gay, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Right? Did that turn out not to be related, based on some study somewhere?
It's based on the endocrine disruptor stuff,
right?
The Shanna Swan stuff. People are already worried about are falling sperm count. It's the same. Yeah. It's the same.
So
thing.
In another context, when it's not Alex Jones, people are like, by the way, just to be clear,
yeah.
Basically every single other thing that guy has said is completely insane, so let's just be clear. Trying, like, there has been this weird movement of people saying, oh, you should listen to him, he says interesting stuff. He's terrible,
awful person.
Has a terrible effect on our
Point is that there's lots of things where there's bits of true information mixed in, and there's not a clear line between, like, you know, is it misinformation to tell people the polio vaccine gives people has led to a creation of a new strand of polio, which is true, right?
But I think some people would say that should be, you know, like the algorithms should downrate that.
But that would be not saying something that isn't. I don't know. I find this whole idea that you can sort of say this side of this line is true stuff, and whereas actually it's really hard working out what's true and what's not.
Okay, so after reading that Nature paper, I'm pretty convinced that the evidence for these like drastically terrible effects of misinformation is actually a lot weaker than we've been led to believe, I think, by people in this field. Mm-hmm. And let's assume, though, let's just for the sake of argument, let's just assume, that. We
it's
agree.
Really bad. We want to do something about it.
Yeah, we agree that something must be done. Someone, please think of the children. What would we do? Well, you know, for some period of the pandemic, the most extreme thing was that social media companies just like deleted stuff that was controversial and banned
people.
Mask
worked or didn't work, depending on what people said at the time.
Yeah, exactly. That was that extreme, and thankfully, even some of the more, you know, enthusiastic misinformation people think that this is a bit over the top and goes against, you know, democratic principles of society of free speech and blah blah blah. I mean, I know that it doesn't technically go against laws about free speech because it was a private company like Twitter or whatever doing the censoring. But
no, but it's not great.
If you think about free speech in a broader sense, it does go against that. Another one, of course, is debunking, like fact checkers. You know, companies like Full Fact and so on do fact checking. Of course,
people say that causes a backfire.
Again, another irony here is that if you were listening to the misinformation researchers for quite some time, you would have believed that it was actually a bad thing to do debunking and fact-checking because of, as you say, the backfire effect, which was based on some studies. I mean, the studies go back to like the 1940s. There's been psychology studies on this kind
and,
of thing.
And to be clear, the idea is like, we say this conspiracy theory isn't true. They go, oh, what? I hadn't heard that. Better go and look that up. And
yeah, or you say like, oh, well, your position is wrong. I remember one of them was about like the Iraq war. Like there weren't weapons of mass destruction there. And then they come out of that. They're like, oh, some, you know, liberal told me that there were no weapons of mass destruction. But I believe it even more strongly now.
Yeah.
Because it's kind of...
Because the liberals are denying it so much.
Yeah, exactly, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's this kind of reactance thing that people apparently have. And there's a really good article by Dan Engber in Slate magazine from 2018 that goes... It was a long article. It goes into... You know, he interviews several of the people in this kind of world and shows that when people came along and tried to do replications of these backfire effect studies with better methods, they couldn't find any evidence of a backfire effect. Facts made people, like telling people facts and debunking things that were wrong made them more likely to believe in the facts.
True things, yeah. Which is amazing how these counterintuitive results often turn out to be counterintuitive for a reason.
Totally, totally. Yeah. Yes, there could be backfire effects under some circumstances. Like I'm sure, you know, we've all debated someone and you kind of entrench yourself, you dig into a position because you don't like the person that's debating you and blah, blah, blah. They, you know, they have different politics from you, or you have some personal blah, blah, blah reason. But it's not a general phenomenon.
No.
And the whole idea seems to be driven by, as so many things, a few eye-catching studies that have fairly dodgy statistics and dodgy methods. And
Fail to replicate.
They fail to replicate.
Okay. So debunking is fine.
It's fine. Yeah, it seems fine. I mean, effects might vary, but I would say that it's important for someone to be able to go online and find, you know, some source that argues against
false things.
You know, false positions. And this is all, you know, part of the usual back and forth in the discourse about stuff. There's another idea, and it's a horrible word, and I hesitate even to say it.
Sorry, get it over with. Well,
it's pre-bunking.
Yeah, it's horrible.
So as opposed to debunking, it's pre-bunking. Yeah. It sounds clumsy as hell. It's horrible. Whoever made that word up should be sent to work in the mines. That's the idea. It's where you like address the claims that you think somebody's about to make. The example that I've seen given, which seems a bit of an unusual example, but it's an example where the Biden administration, like in 2022, put out all this information saying like we think Russia's about to invade Ukraine and they're probably going to tell you loads of lies about it to justify an attack. So just so you know, we're telling you that we have intelligence that, you know, we think that they're about to lie, you know, and spread propaganda about it. And that was very useful because it did actually, you know, help people understand the situation that was going on.
Yes, although major invasions of neighboring countries are fairly rare.
Well, as I say, it's an unusual.
Yeah, it wouldn't have worked with COVID. Like we think there'll be a world pandemic along in a few minutes, and everyone's going to get really overexcited about ivermectin.
Totally. So it does seem a trickier thing. And then there's this idea of cognitive immunology.
Oh God, it sounds like an annoying metaphor already.
Yeah, this is the idea that you can vaccinate people against misinformation by giving them some little bit of the wrong information that they're about to encounter. And so, the incorrect information that they're about to encounter. And so it kind of builds up their tolerance to it, and you can show them that it's wrong. That's the kind of more fact-based side of it. And then there's the more logical side of it, which is you help people spot what have been called the fingerprints of misinformation.
Okay, I've lost all this already. I'm sure it makes sense. Carry on.
Well, I should say, you know, there's a book called Foolproof by a Cambridge psychology professor called Sander van der Linden, who, full disclosure, I have had a horrible argument with him, or multiple horrible arguments with him on social media, and he remains one of the most unpleasant people I've ever spoken to in any context.
Stuart's high disagreeability score once again, getting the studies show in trouble with people. But yeah, just tell us what you really think, Stuart.
Yeah, well, that's my honest opinion.
Yeah.
We don't have time to go through all the fingerprints that are in his book. They are discrediting, emotion, polarization, impersonation, conspiracy, and trolling. So those are the things that...
Depict, I notice.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, depict. So you the idea is that you educate people about this, and then they will remember depict, and then they will be able to resist misinformation when they see it.
Yeah. Okay.
Suffice to say, I'm very skeptical of this. I'm very skeptical that people, first of all, have the time or inclination to think about depict every time they encounter any information, whether it's good or bad information. It's like when you tell people about logical fallacies, like, you know, you educate people about the Mott and Bailey fallacy.
Appeal to authority or whatever. Yeah,
exactly. Appeal to authority or, you know, all these kind of fallacies. It's fun for nerds to talk about online, but I wonder how useful it is for the average person to know about that and whether it's actually that easy to spot these things in people's rhetoric. I've no idea.
Well, that book I mentioned about the conspiracy theory thing earlier on, he's there. These are the five. It was about science deniers, and he said these are the five kinds of reasoning that affect all science deniers.
Like, oh, right,
it's just not true.
It's just simply not true. And I'm sure these things are useful. Like, I'm sure in some cases you could say, oh yeah, okay, this person is appealing to a conspiracy for which there isn't evidence here and all that. But I just feel like you're better off taking each argument on its merits rather than trying to appeal to these kind of things. And by the way, when I argued with him, he classified my argument according to some of these things. And I found the level of stupidity. Anyway, so the second thing I'm skeptical of is that misinformation, as you say, actually even does have any fingerprints that are worth spotting. And this is another thing that Dan Williams has pointed out. He looked at the E of depict, which is emotion. Mm-hmm. So there's a study that shows apparently that misinformation uses emotional language at 20 times the rate of reliable information, right?
Okay. Immediately an effect size, I guess. No, it doesn't.
Well, it depends what you're comparing, doesn't it? And it turns out that the reliable information was the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and The Guardian. And the unreliable information was websites from this thing called the Fake News Corpus, which is like, well, Dan Williams describes them as extremely fringe, low-quality websites.
So sort of ones that have the black background and green writing on them.
InfoWars would be one and various other things like that. So he says, what we end up learning is that outlets like the New York Times tend to use bigger words, longer sentences, and less emotive language than articles from fringe, clickbait, fake news, and conspiratorial websites like InfoWars. Does this demonstrate that misinformation in general features more emotive language? Of course not. Elite broadsheet newspapers are not at all representative of accurate and reliable communication, and the sample of misinformation is not at all representative of false or misleading information. Here are just some of the kinds of misinformation it misses. Misinformation from commentators on social media websites. Elite corporate misinformation. Misinformation from mainstream political elites and campaigns. Governmental misinformation. Misinformative elite commentary. Misinformation within science due to fraud. Extremely questionable research practices and so on. Misinformation disseminated within religions. Misinformation associated with partisan news outlets. And most tellingly, misinformation published by outlets like the New York Times, The Guardian, and the Wall Street Journal. Misinformation which, he finishes, is much more consequential than that produced by extremely fringe websites with a tiny audience of avid conspiracy theorists. So there's an awful lot of stuff
out there which this won't pick up.
If you're just choosing stuff that we all know is mad and then comparing that to stuff that you personally agree is good, you're going to miss out. That's not a reliable epistemology, is what I'm saying.
No.
To work out what's true.
There's two things there that, exactly. I bet you the example that we've used before, the Lancet paper, I bet that didn't have very emotive language. It's a scientific paper.
Yeah.
The point is people believed it. And so
the Andrew Wakefield paper.
Yeah, exactly. So
where he claimed, again, just in case anyone doesn't have the full context, where he claimed that vaccines could potentially cause this autistic enterocolitis thing, which was found in autistic kids, and you know the strong implication was that vaccines cause autism. Yeah, sorry, please carry on.
It was a crap study, and it was also fraudulent.
Yes.
But nonetheless, I'm sure it was not written in an emotive language.
Yeah.
but also, I have to say, like, the vaccination is a weird analogy there. In the for a vaccination for
to vaccinate people against misinformation.
Yeah. We're going to give you a bit of false information, like a little bit of dead misinformation to protect you against this. It's just weird. Like, you're giving people tools to fight against it, presumably, but not like a little bit of we'll tell you that vaccines sort of cause autism a few months in advance and hope that sort of settles in your brain. It's just a weird analogy.
I agree. It's completely stupid.
Yeah.
Just pulp that whole book. Go back a few episodes, and here's a classic example. We talked about the CAS review about youth gender medicine. The whole reason that was interesting in any way, and it was such a bombshell when it arrived, was because, and I don't imply any conspiracy here, I just think people got it wrong. Elite media outlets, including places like the New York Times and places like that. Lots of charities, reliable non-governmental organizations, politicians, and so on, had been pushing the idea that the science on youth gender medicine was totally settled.
Yeah.
And we had loads of really good quality evidence. And then the CAS review came along, and it turned out that, of course, it wasn't. They did a systematic review and, dug into the data. It's absolutely not solid. It's absolutely not settled.
Yeah, and it blew this massive, right? The reason it caused this massive eruption was because people that who sort of just taken it as read from reading the The Guardian or whatever.
Yes.
Because, it sort of really shook their... It became as a massive surprise, basically, because it was new to them.
Yeah, exactly. And then you just have to look at the work of someone like Jesse Singel, friend of the show, who, had for years before the CAS report been pointing out the kind of wildly incorrect things that people had said, including in scientific papers about this topic. And by the way, forget the CAS review. Just take a step back. Look at almost any episode of this podcast. We find when we look at the quality of science that's reported in scientific papers, which are in peer-reviewed journals in most cases, it's really often crap.
Yeah.
Low-quality rubbish science. Think about all the nutritional papers that we've talked about that are just, correlation causation nightmares.
Yeah, if misinformation in scientific papers was rare, we wouldn't be able to do this podcast.
There you go. Yeah, exactly. And of course, we've also talked about, and this is mentioned in Dan Williams' long list of misinformation, but we've also mentioned scientific fraud, elite journals, fooled, hoodwinked by fraudulent scientists who make stuff up.
Yeah.
And then get away with it for years. The Lancet. And Andrew Wakefield being one example, but there are so many more. And then sometimes this bad science filters out into the real world. The youth gender medicine is one example, but doctors, politicians, the media, this stuff gets out, and it's from elite outlets.
Yeah, not from green text websites.
Yeah,
like sending angry things to each other about whatever vaccines.
Yeah, it's so stupid to use only. Broadly use The Guardian and The New York Times and The Wall Street Journal as reliable sources. There's a good recent post by Matt Iglesias on this as well, which we'll put in the show notes.
And everyone saying how completely terrible fossil fuels are all the time, without any sort of pointing out that they actually have lots of important uses at the moment. That's misinformation. That is spreading false facts.
Yeah, misleading facts. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Elite misinformation is an underrated phenomenon, he talks about. Or an underrated problem, I should say. So that's one thing. That's a majorly important thing to bear in mind. And how does the misinformation labeling perspective deal with the fact that elite institutions and researchers and high status people regularly put out false facts? Well, it just doesn't.
Oh,
it just doesn't really deal with that at all. And if you question stuff, then we're about to find out. There's a really good paper published earlier this year that tries to just get people
calm the heck down,
calm down a little bit, and you know, they say, yes, there are cases that we can basically all agree on that are misinformation. And but there, it's just hard. It's just really hard to discover what's real and what is misinformation and what isn't, and like what's true. That's what science is all about. And they say, I'll let you read the quote.
Okay. Given the stakes involved, misinformation researchers cannot afford to employ an I know it when I see it epistemology that conflates ideas that researchers personally disagree with for some reason with ideas that are objectively false. It may be the case that such an epistemology gets it right sometimes, but it might be impossible to know how often. As such, we may find that circumspection on our own part is best. Oh. I mean, it's just so true. Like, it's obvious. It's really hard to know what's true. It's so hard. And you shouldn't be confident about a lot of stuff.
Exactly. Like, I know it when I see it thing is, that's a reference to the definition of pornography. Which some US politician at some point, you know, said.
No, it was a judge.
Yeah. Judge, well, judges are often politicians in the US as well, aren't they? Like,
and porn users.
They get voted. And maybe they use pornography. But the idea was that, yeah, there's no way to define it in words, but I know it when I see it. And that's kind of like what misinformation researchers are doing with misinformation. They're kind of relying on an in-group agreement on what misinformation is.
Yeah. Yeah, sort of consensus, definition rather than actually saying, writing down a firm. I mean, you know, that's...
And how could you write down a firm thing, given all we've just talked about?
Yes, it's true. It's true. I mean, it doesn't necessarily make... I mean, you can't always do good definitions of things, but that doesn't always mean they're false. Like, I think about this in the context of AI sometimes. People,
true.
People saying, you know, you can't even define what intelligence is. How can we make artificial? Well, okay, yeah. Tell that to the nanobots that are reconstituting your atoms to make paperclips.
Yeah. Talk about what they can do and capability. Yeah, totally. Yeah,
they're not even really intelligent.
Let's not get hung up on definitions particularly, but we do have to have some sort of epistemology, some sort of way of working out what's true that doesn't just basically say that you know, we're liberal leaning academics, so liberal leaning stuff is probably right. And remember the phrase that we all used to love when we were younger, which was reality has a liberal bias.
Oh yes, oh god, yeah. And
very embarrassing if you've ever you know, believed that or spread that quote. Very embarrassing and naive.
Yes,
I would argue. but I think basically that is what a lot of misinformation researchers actually believe. So this has been a bit of a backlash against the whole misinformation idea, and some misinformation studies researchers pushed back in a commentary in Nature magazine. Now, I've written that this is a backlash against the backlash, and there's thus a backlash squared. But you have...
Yeah, that's obviously misinformation.
You pulled me up on doubled. That.
Yeah, it's a backlash doubled. It's two misinformations, two backlashes. So 2B, so not M to the power, not B to the power 2.
You're right, Tom. Apologize for spreading misinformation in the notes to the show.
Notes.
So let's look at this commentary that they wrote. Now, it's got some big names on it. Van der Linden's on there. Some other people you might recognize. Naomi Oreskes, who wrote that book. Merchants of Doubt, about how fossil fuel which will be relevant, fossil fuel and tobacco companies spread, in their case I guess, disinformation to make their products sell more of their products. So it defends misinformation research, and I would argue we're deep into the paid section now, Tom, so I can say whatever I want.
Say what you like.
I think it uses absolutely disgusting rhetorical tactics to smear critics of the misinformation research world.
Okay. Do you want me to read?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to read it out, but I would read it out in a whining, petulant tone. So
maybe it's best if I take it off. Yeah. Okay. The idea that misinformation cannot.
Do it in your normal Jacob Rees-Mogg
gravitas voice. Yes. Yeah, exactly. The idea that misinformation cannot be reliably identified is often accompanied by claims that it is premature to conclude that there is a problem and therefore premature to act. This argument is familiar. It was used in the decades-long campaigns led by the tobacco and fossil fuel industries to delay regulation and mitigative action. I'll point out that in the notes, Stuart has left sick comma splicing originally. He's picking them up on their punctuation.
Badly written article. Yeah. Badly written, badly argued, awful article.
Isn't that
such a scummy tactic to say that if you disagree with misinformation researchers, you're actually doing something similar to the tobacco and fossil fuel industries to delay regulation about climate change and cancer? It doesn't even make sense on its own merits, because it's not like these people are being paid. Like, who are they being paid by? Big misinformation?
Well, it's the Russians, I guess. Yeah.
I would not be surprised if that's what these people believed. It is mental. So I'm angrier about this than I am about almost any other topic, because it's the whole...
It's poisoning the well.
What I mean is, the reason I'm particularly upset about it is because it's the narcissism of small differences, isn't it? These are supposed to be people... you were the chosen one. You were supposed to debunk misinformation, but you're just making it worse, and you're using bad arguments when you're doing it.
It's near group versus far group.
Totally.
Out group versus, these people aren't, they're not random people and believing a different religion. They're apostates.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then unfounded criticism that is directed at misinformation researchers provides intellectual cover for disinformers and makes this work even harder. Cry me a river.
Just fuck off. I'm sorry, but I've written in the notes, fuck off. Because I can confirm. Scientific criticism of your work is not the same as being a paid shill for a tobacco company, and nor does providing cover for bad people, you know, if that is indeed true, mean that all the arguments people make against you are wrong. It's like they have this delusion of grandeur that they're doing this amazing messianic crusade against misinformation. And it's unbelievably rich of these people to claim that there are all these fingerprints of misinformation. You can tell when someone's making a bad argument, blah, 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 blah. When they're using some of the most sleazy rhetorical tactics, smearing critics and saying that they're close to fossil fuel companies and people who want to spread cancer, trying to discredit them. The first thing in that depict thing is discrediting people. You try to discredit them by saying they're like a fucking fossil fuel company. And these are just people who have clearly argued, good faith critiques of your work. And this is how you deal with it. And you're supposed to be the people that are promoting a better discourse that doesn't have any mis or disinformation in it. Get the fuck out of here. It's fucking enraging.
Sorry, I just wandered off to get a cup of coffee.
Sorry. I do apologize, Tom.
No, it's fine. No, tell me, I can tell that you're a bit worked up about this, Stuart, but it's fine. You know, you're just right. Like, you're right. The idea that you can't fact check me because it'll give cover to the bad people is just not okay, especially from a fact checker. Yeah, it's gross.
Okay, I want to just let's just lower the temperature, just take it easy, and bring this to a topical conclusion. Because as we're recording this, Tom, just a few hours ago, Joe Biden has decided not to run again for the U.S. presidency.
Yes, because in the wake of the debate in which he seemed shockingly unaware of his surroundings,
cognitively impaired, you'd say, due to aging and so on. And I have every sympathy with that. And I'm glad this has happened, because it seemed like a really bad situation. That they were the country was getting into.
Yes.
But if you go back to, I believe, December last year, Dan Williams, who we've mentioned a couple of times before, was looking through some of the misinformation research and found that one of the studies that had been published here classified a particular meme image as misinformation. It's a joke internet meme, and it has Barack Obama talking to Joe Biden, and Obama is saying, "I'm endorsing you, Joe." And then Biden is saying, "For what?" Now, you might
think
it's
not particularly funny.
It's not particularly funny. It's a bit tasteless. It's a political meme. What do you expect?
Yeah.
Now, the question is whether it's appropriate to call that misinformation.
Yeah, because to be clear, it was in the study, and that was labeled as
If you spread that in the study, I can't remember exactly what they did in the study, but if they spread that in the study, that was kind of just spreading misinformation. Now, Sander van der Linden comes in and says, Just for context, the study classified this image as political misinformation because it plays into the well-documented false narrative that Biden is senile, notably fact-checked as false. And then he goes on to ask people whether they think it's misinformation. Now, obviously that was completely absurd at the time, and I made fun of him for it. But it appears even madder now that there's pretty much, you know, a consensus really rapidly grew on all sides that Biden's age is a massive impediment to running again for president. And in fact, I've written in the notes, by the time you listen to this, he might have dropped out. And in fact, I was correct. Yes. He has dropped out.
About 2 hours ago now,
since I wrote these notes. But then after the debate performance, look at how van der Linden doubled down. Someone pointed out that Joe Biden's debate performance highlights how public debate about misinformation, but also academic definitions of the concept, can be muddied and biased. And he's referring to this discussion about, you know, saying that it's misinformation to say that Biden is having, you know, aging issues. Mm. Van der Linden argues, this is a bizarre take. There was a documented propaganda campaign portraying Biden as senile when clearly he wasn't, as per experts. Like everyone, people age, he's getting old and clearly struggled in the debate. This doesn't change the historic misinfo campaign. Now,
well, surely it's only misinfo if he wasn't senile.
Well, Tom, you're arguing with a misinformation researcher here, so...
I do apologise. An expert.
An expert, you could say. Yeah. The guy that he was arguing with, Christian Peter Hoffman, comes back and says, Sander, there have been countless clips of Biden struggling over the past months and years. Are you saying citizens or journalists should have to wait for experts, and which experts, to confirm his infirmity before they can address this issue? Your response raises so many questions. And van der Linden's response to that is, of course, we can't just be saying random stuff without expert assessment, especially on medical issues. P.S. Experts have commented and fact-checked prior claims as false, and we should await whether this assessment changes, in my opinion. That is about the recent debate performance.
None of us wanted Biden to be struggling like that, but he was obviously struggling, and it's mad not to put a pretty high... I'm not going to wait for some psychologist or gerontologist to come in and say... You know, actually, you know, this is often happens with older people. They start losing. I knew that. You don't need an expert.
It's crazy to live your life like that. Mm. Not to mention, like, really authoritarian. Like, we have to wait till the authorities tell you something before you can talk about it. Mm. Otherwise, you'll be accused of misinformation.
But also, senile isn't like, it's not like people diagnose senility in a formal way. That it just means old and losing.
Yeah, exactly. Faculties, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's the whole. But isn't that the whole point? Like,
it's
people can watch the videos and see that something is wrong. And if they say senile, if they say whatever, I don't think they're part of a propaganda campaign to point that out. And I don't think I have to say, as much as I'm very much on the side of Biden in this particular, you know, if I was American, I would have voted for him in this election had he been standing, I think.
Completely ruined our entire completely apolitical week that we exist. we float in the ether above petty.
Happy to admit that I would not have voted for Donald Trump in the election.
Disgusting. Yeah. Sorry, carry on.
Personally, despite I don't identify with, you know, a particular party or whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm not American. I would say it's not propaganda for someone to have pointed out that he was struggling. You're not running a misinformation campaign to point to the videos and say something is up here. Maybe this guy who's almost 80 years old.
He's 81.
Well, I know, but like at the time, you know, the years preceding that. Maybe this guy who's clearly very different to what he was just 5 years ago. Is struggling, and you know, mainstream. If you want mainstream people like Ezra Klein talked about this and made this point well before the debate. I think Ezra Klein's article was in January or February, where he said this is really bad. You know, he should step down, and go back to our episode on cognitive decline, and you'll see that we were way ahead of this as well. We talked about this. I criticized people who kind of were obviously ideologically biased and weren't. You know, didn't have their eyes open to this.
Yeah, I will say that you were well ahead, because I, as we've said, I flatly refused to watch videos.
Don't watch YouTube.
So I didn't, exactly. So I didn't see anything that might, especially, might make me feel like unhappy or make me cringe.
Well, they're certainly cringe. It's horrible. Yeah, it is horrible to watch, and that's what the world saw in that debate. It was horrible to watch. But the, you know, according to the misinformation experts, you have to check with the experts before you can say that you saw anything wrong with the debate or anything was unpleasant to watch. A mad thing to believe.
Yeah, absolutely bonkers. Yeah.
Let's finish this episode with a couple of quotes. So my friend Ruxandra Tesleanu has a blog post, and she's a biologist who writes a Substack, a very good Substack, which we'll link to in the show notes. Mm-hmm. She had with a rhetorical flourish, I think you'd say, she describes this kind of thing, misinformation, you know, believing in misinformation research perspective as the road to mental serfdom, you know, after the Hayek.
Yeah, after the Hayek road to serfdom, yeah.
And she's basically arguing that you're just letting experts tell you what to believe and conforming with them. And that goes completely against the spirit of science, rationality, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, and also doing your best to find out what's true with the complicated evidence in front of you rather than just taking it from one person.
Yeah. And she also points out that it makes it easier, like scientists. In fact, let me just get the actual quote from her. And she talks about this in detail. It's well worth a read and conforms pretty closely with what we've said here, I'd say, talking about conformity. Yeah, this is something I do agree with. The incentives in academia are aligned such that it's much more profitable to invent a new field, like misinformation, and publish a book about it and do some high-status social signaling in the process than to actually perform the hard and onerous work of going against your colleagues, explaining why some of their approaches are wrong. So she talks about that in detail. It's well worth reading that. I also think if you're at all interested in this, you should read at least some of Dan Williams' work. He's published a lot of articles on this, and including a review of the Foolproof book and various other things. So he says in one of his articles, it might be emotionally comforting to classify all challenges to preferred liberal orthodoxies of the day as misinformation. It might even serve short-term propagandistic purposes. However, it ultimately makes you look silly in the eyes of a less biased public and erodes trust in social science and liberal media outlets.
Yeah, it seems true to me.
Amen. Yeah. As far as I can tell. Anyone, in my view, who has a sophisticated view of science and a sophisticated view of philosophy, epistemology, whatever, knows that it's just really hard to get to the bottom of controversial questions. We've tried it. Every week on this podcast, we've tried some kind of controversial question, and doubtless we get things wrong, we get the emphasis wrong all the time.
We literally have an irregular, but probably not regular enough, mea culpa episode in which we explain all the
things. Yes, we get wrong. And we do regularly disagree with people who you would consider to be experts. And of course, you know, just to be clear, we do agree with, you know, the proposition that one, you know, there are clearly factually inaccurate information, clearly factually inaccurate pieces of information out there, and it's good to debunk them.
Yep.
Totally agree with that. That's what we do.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, there's maybe a whole other episode in this. Relying on experts when you don't yourself have the expertise is, in many cases, the only way of getting to the bottom of things and also the only way to live your life in a way that doesn't involve, you know, learning every single science from first principles when we live in a very complicated world. You've got to at some point have trust in experts.
Yeah.
But the problem is that these people are arguing that we should have blind faith in experts, even in cases where, you know, like that debate, your own eyes are telling you something fairly obvious.
Yeah, I mean, this would mean like going to, and so the growth mindset is the one I keep coming back to.
Yeah.
If we just accepted, then they'll be saying, well, you know, these little tiny interventions have these huge outsized effects. Well, therefore, we should go and be telling all the kids in schools to work, to, you know, praise them for how hard they worked rather than how clever they are, and it'll totally transform. But you can see that it's just the fact that some statistics say it in a scientific paper is not, it's some evidence, but it's not, you shouldn't overrule everything you know about how humans work on its own, you know?
Totally.
You need to have some willingness to go against what the experts are saying sometimes.
Completely. It's the only way that we can do things. The whole basis of science is based on people, you know, arguing with each other, and the whole idea of peer review, as flawed as it is about, you know, bringing other perspectives in and red teaming each other's work and so on.
Anyway,
it doesn't mean, we don't agree that, you know, misinformation is somehow super easy to spot, or that you can have a scheme that just tells you what's misinformation and what isn't.
No, that's the idea of a checklist, a sort of tick these boxes, now it's misinformation. I mean, it's misinformation if it's not true. How do you determine what's true or not?
Yeah.
That's really what it can be, you know, and determining what is true and what isn't is really fucking hard.
Really hard. Really very difficult. And what you have to do is look at the quality of the evidence and the argument, and that is often extremely difficult. And we know that there are things like groupthink and political bias and error and fraud and all these kind of things that come in and that make finding out what's true much, much more difficult, even on top of the difficult task of, you know, doing all your experiments and getting them designed right and doing all the statistics right and running everything correctly and all that. Even on top of all that stuff, there's all the additional human biases. We're trying to do that on this show. We're trying to work out what's true to the best of our ability, which is limited in all sorts of ways. And we're happy to admit that. And I think, you know, at any time that we tell you that you just need to have blind faith in this or that expert is the time that you can take us out the back and have a shot.
Or at least stop subscribing.
Or at least unsubscribe to the podcast, because it's just simply goes completely against everything that I currently believe. And I would argue that if experts start telling you that, and then you just simply open your eyes and look at all the evidence of experts going wrong, that's going to have a major, you know, as Dan Williams says, it's going to erode trust in what these experts are telling you. And that's very dangerous, because we need to have justified faith in our institutions and what experts are telling us. And this is this whole misinformation thing being so biased to one side, being based on such poor argumentation and such authoritarian thinking styles. It's really dangerous in many respects, because it's part of the way that we and again we return to the subject of irony. It's part of the way that people have these days begun to distrust institutions, and that's only going to have bad outcomes.
Now we need to calm Stuart down and get him a nice cup of cocoa. Okay. I think Stuart's had a long day, bless him, so let's just go settle down, darling. And
thank you,
but
Tom.
Yes, thank you so much for listening, everyone.
Yes, thanks for listening. And of course, if you're at this point, then you have subscribed, so thank you for subscribing.
So yes, so thank you very much for listening. We really appreciate it. We couldn't make the show without you guys in particular.
Yes.
And we hope this was a fun one in which Stuart very nearly had a coronary. And
we'll return to somewhat more chill topics next week.
Yeah. Bye-bye, guys. Take care.